Audible Inc. presents Global Warming, A Very Short Introduction by Mark Maslin. Read by Kevin Parisot.
Preface to Second Edition. The great thing I have been told about writing a preface is that no one reads it, so I can be as radical as I like. In my opinion, global warming is good for humanity. This may seem a very strange statement, so let me explain before you throw the book away in disgust. There are two major problems facing humanity in the 21st century: global poverty and global warming. Let's consider global poverty. At the moment, we live in a world of plenty, where 800 million people go to bed hungry and 15 million children starve to death each year. Fundamentally, global poverty is about unequal distribution of global wealth and resources. To alleviate global poverty, we need to help poor countries to develop as quickly as possible. The golden rule of development is that it is always accompanied by an expansion of the amount of energy used. If these countries use the cheapest route, then their energy will be produced using carbon-based technologies such as coal, gas, and oil. For example, China is building a new coal-fired power station every 4 days. This, of course, will accelerate global warming. So to deal with global warming, we must deal with developing countries, and thus we must, for the first time in humanity's history, tackle the unequal distribution of global wealth. Hence, global warming is making us face the forgotten billions of people on the planet, and we must make the world a fairer place. In the 21st century, we must deal with both global poverty and global warming. Introduction. Global warming is the most important science issue of the 21st century, challenging the very structure of our global society. The problem is that global warming is not just a scientific concern, but encompasses economics, sociology, geopolitics, local politics, and individuals' choice of lifestyle. Global warming is caused by the massive increase of greenhouse gases, such as carbon dioxide, in the atmosphere, resulting from the burning of fossil fuels and deforestation. There is clear evidence that we have already elevated concentrations of atmospheric carbon dioxide to their highest level for the last 500,000 years, and perhaps even longer. Scientists believe that this is causing the Earth to warm faster than at any other time during, at the very least, the past 2,000 years. The most recent report by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, IPCC, amounting to nearly 3,000 pages of detailed review and analysis of published research, declares that the scientific uncertainties of global warming are essentially resolved. The report states that there is clear evidence for a 0.75 degrees Celsius rise in global temperatures and 22 centimeter rise in sea level during the 20th century. The IPCC synthesis also predicts that global temperatures could rise further by between 1.1 degrees Celsius and 6.4 degrees Celsius by 2100, and sea level could rise by between 28 centimeters and 79 centimeters, more if the melting of Greenland and Antarctica accelerates. In addition, weather patterns will become less predictable, and the occurrence of extreme climate events, such as storms, floods, heat waves, and droughts, will increase. This book tries to unpick the controversies that surround the global warming hypothesis and hopefully provides an incentive to read more on the subject. It starts with an explanation of global warming and climate change, and this is followed by a review of how the global warming hypothesis was developed. The book examines the evidence showing that global warming is already occurring and the science behind the dramatic future predictions. The potentially devastating effects of global warming on human society, including drastic changes in health, agriculture, the economy, water resources, coastal regions, storms, and other extreme climate events, and biodiversity are evaluated. For each of these areas, scientists and social scientists have made estimates of the potential direct impacts, and these are discussed. There are also potential surprises that the global climate system might have in store for us, exacerbating future climate change. These include the very real possibility that Greenland and/or the Antarctic could melt, raising sea level by meters. Or the North Atlantic-driven deep ocean circulation could change, producing extreme seasonal weather in Europe. There is the possibility of the Amazon rainforest burning in the future, accelerating global warming. Finally, there is a deadly threat lurking beneath the oceans. Huge reserves of methane, which could be released in giant burps of death if the oceans warm up sufficiently, again accelerating the warming of the planet. The final chapters of the book look at global politics and possible solutions to global warming. The Stern Report in 2007 suggested that a global reduction in carbon emissions would cost about 1% of world gross domestic product, GDP, to achieve, compared to the consequences, which could cost up to 20% of world GDP. This is a call to arms, shouting at us that we must quickly make the global economy more flexible and responsive to the challenge of a zero-carbon world economy. The last chapter provides a vision of what a zero-carbon world would look like. In this book, I have tried to introduce the reader to the complexities of both the science and the politics of climate change. This is not a self-help, what can I do to make it better book. If you want to alleviate your guilt, there are plenty of books out there for you. I am not against individuals taking concerted action to deal with global warming. Rather, this book is about the large picture. I, however, believe the fundamental solutions to global warming will be at the global political and economic level. Global warming provides us with a unique opportunity to restructure global economics and at the same time provide a mechanism to alleviate poverty around the world. Current economic development is always accompanied by a massive expansion in a country's energy requirement. The cheapest way to meet this is through a carbon-based economy. So rapid industrial development and poverty alleviation lead to an acceleration in global warming. The twin problems of global warming and global poverty challenge our current concepts of the nation-state versus global responsibility. They challenge the short-term vision of our political leaders. Be under no illusion. If global warming is not taken seriously, we will all suffer. But of course, it will be the poorest people in our global community who, as usual, suffer most. Chapter 1. What is global warming? The Earth's natural greenhouse. The temperature of the Earth is determined by the balance between the input from energy from the sun and the reflection of some of this energy back into space. Certain atmospheric gases are critical to this temperature balance and are known as greenhouse gases. The energy received from the sun is in the form of shortwave radiation, that is, in the visible spectrum, and ultraviolet radiation. On average, about one-third of this solar radiation that hits the Earth is reflected back to space. Of the remainder, some is absorbed by the atmosphere, but most is absorbed by the land and oceans. The Earth's surface becomes warm and, as a result, emits long-wave infrared radiation. The greenhouse gases trap and re-emit some of this long-wave radiation and warm the atmosphere. Naturally occurring greenhouse gases include water vapor, carbon dioxide, ozone, methane, and nitrous oxide. And together, they create a natural greenhouse or blanket effect. Without this natural greenhouse effect, the Earth would be at least 35 degrees Celsius colder. Even though the greenhouse gases are often depicted in diagrams as one layer to demonstrate their blanket effect, they are, in fact, mixed throughout the atmosphere. Past climate and the role of carbon dioxide. One of the ways in which we know that atmospheric carbon dioxide is important in controlling global climate is through the study of our past climate. Over the last 2.5 million years, the Earth's climate has cycled between the Great Ice Ages, with ice sheets over 3 kilometers thick over North America and Europe, to conditions that were even milder than they are today. These changes are extremely rapid if compared to other geological variations, such as the movement of continents around the globe, where we are looking at a time period of millions of years. But how do we know about these massive ice ages and the role of carbon dioxide? The evidence mainly comes from ice cores drilled in both Antarctica and Greenland. As snow falls, it is light and fluffy and contains a lot of air. When this is slowly compacted to form ice, some of this air is trapped. By extracting these air bubbles trapped in the ancient ice, scientists can measure the percentage of greenhouse gases that were present in the past atmosphere. Scientists have drilled over 2 miles down into both the Greenland and Antarctic ice sheets, which has enabled them to reconstruct the amount of greenhouse gases that occurred in the atmosphere over the last 500,000 years. By examining the oxygen and hydrogen isotopes in the ice core, it is possible to estimate the temperature at which the ice was formed. The results are striking, as greenhouse gases such as atmospheric carbon dioxide, CO2, and methane, CH4, co-vary with temperatures over the last 650,000 years. This strongly supports the idea that the carbon dioxide content in the atmosphere and global temperature are closely linked. That is, when CO2 and CH4 increase, the temperature is found to increase, and vice versa. This is our greatest concern for future climate. If levels of greenhouse gases continue to rise, so will the temperature of our atmosphere. The study of past climate, as we will see throughout this book, provides many clues about what could happen in the future. One of the most worrying results from the study of ice cores and lake and deep sea sediments is that past climate change has varied regionally by at least 5 degrees Celsius in a few decades, suggesting that climate follows a non-linear path. Hence, we should expect sudden and dramatic surprises when greenhouse gas levels reach an as-yet unknown trigger point in the future. The rise in atmospheric carbon dioxide during the industrial period. One of the few claims of the global warming debate that seems to be universally accepted is that there is clear proof that levels of atmospheric carbon dioxide have been rising ever since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. The first measurements of CO2 concentrations in the atmosphere started in 1958 at an altitude of about 4,000 meters on the summit of Mauna Loa Mountain in Hawaii. The measurements were made here to be remote from local sources of pollution. What they have clearly shown is that atmospheric concentrations of CO2 have increased every single year since 1958. The mean concentration of approximately 316 parts per million by volume, PPMV, in 1958 rose to approximately 379 PPMV in 2005. The annual variations in the Mauna Loa Observatory are mostly due to CO2 uptake by growing plants. The uptake is highest in the Northern Hemisphere springtime. Hence, every spring there is a drop in atmospheric carbon dioxide, which unfortunately does nothing to the overall trend towards ever higher values. This carbon dioxide data from the Mauna Loa Observatory can be combined with the detailed work on ice cores to produce a complete record of atmospheric carbon dioxide since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. What this shows is that atmospheric CO2 has increased from a pre-industrial concentration of about 280 ppmv to nearly 380 ppmv at present, which is an increase of 160 billion tons, representing an overall 30% increase. To put this increase into context, ice core evidence shows that over the last 650,000 years, the natural change in atmospheric carbon dioxide has been between 180 and 300 ppmv. The variation between warm and cold periods is about 80 ppmv, almost the same as the CO2 pollution that we have put into the atmosphere over the last 100 years. At the end of the last ice age, this carbon dioxide increase of 80 ppmv was accompanied by a global warming of 6 degrees Celsius. Though the ultimate cause of the end of the last ice age was changes in the Earth's orbit around the Sun, scientists studying past climates have realized the central role atmospheric carbon dioxide has as a climate feedback, translating these external variations into the waxing and waning of ice ages. It demonstrates that the level of pollution that we have already caused in one century is comparable to the natural variations which took thousands of years. The Enhanced Greenhouse Effect. The debate surrounding the global warming hypothesis is whether the additional greenhouse gases being added to the atmosphere will enhance the natural greenhouse effect. Global warming skeptics argue that though levels of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere are rising, this will not cause global warming, as either the effects are too small or there are other natural feedbacks which will counter major warming. Even if one takes the view of the majority of scientists and accepts that burning fossil fuels will cause warming, there is a different debate over exactly how much temperatures will increase. Then there is the discussion about whether global climate will respond in a linear manner to the extra greenhouse gases, or whether there is a climate threshold waiting for us. These issues are tackled later in the book. Who produces the pollution? The United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change was created to produce the first international agreement on reducing global greenhouse gas emissions. However, this task is not as simple as it first appears, as carbon dioxide emissions are not evenly produced by countries. The first major source of carbon dioxide is the burning of fossil fuels, since 4/5 of global carbon dioxide emissions comes from energy production, industrial processes, and transport. These are not evenly distributed around the world because of the unequal distribution of industry and wealth. North America, Europe, and Asia emit over 90% of the global industrially produced carbon dioxide. Moreover, historically, the developed nations have emitted much more than less developed countries. The second major source, accounting for 1/5 of global carbon dioxide emissions, is as a result of land use changes. These emissions come primarily from the cutting down of forests for the purposes of agriculture, urbanization, or roads. When large areas of rainforests are cut down, the land often turns into less productive grassland, with considerably reduced capacity for storing CO2. Here, the pattern of carbon dioxide emissions is different, with South America, Asia, and Africa being responsible for over 90% of present-day land use change emissions. This raises important ethical issues because it is difficult to tell these countries to stop deforesting, when, historically, this has already occurred in much of North America and Europe before the beginning of the 20th century. In terms of the amount of carbon dioxide released, industrial processes still significantly outweigh land use changes. So, who were the bad guys in causing this increase in atmospheric carbon dioxide? Of course, it is the developed countries who historically have emitted most of the anthropogenic, man-made greenhouse gases, as they have been emitting since the start of the Industrial Revolution in the latter half of the 18th century. But this is quickly becoming irrelevant, because according to International Energy Authority projections, between 2000 and 2030, the world will emit more carbon dioxide in the atmosphere than between 1750 and 2000. This is because mature, industrialized economies are energy hungry and burn more and more fossil fuels. While less developed countries are striving to increase their population's standard of living, they are also increasing their emissions of greenhouse gases at a huge rate, since economic development is closely associated with energy production. For example, China has now become the biggest emitter of carbon dioxide in the world, overtaking the USA in 2007. However, when considered per capita, the Chinese emissions are 4 times lower than those of the USA, who are top of the per capita list. So all the draft international agreements concerning cutting emissions since the Rio Earth Summit in 1992 have, for moral reasons, not included the developing world, as this is seen as an unfair break on its economic development. However, as we will see later in this book, this is a significant issue because, for example, both China and India are rapidly industrializing, and with a combined population of over 2.3 billion people, they will produce a huge amount of pollution. Therefore, any agreement after 2012 will have to include the developing world. What is the IPCC? The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, IPCC, was established in 1988 jointly by the United Nations Environmental Panel and World Meteorological Organization because of worries about the possibility of global warming. The purpose of the IPCC is the continued assessment of the state of knowledge on the various aspects of climate change, including scientific, environmental, and socioeconomic impacts and response strategies. The IPCC does not undertake independent scientific research. Rather, it brings together all key research published in the world and produces a consensus. The IPCC is, thus, recognized as the most authoritative scientific and technical voice on climate change, and its assessments have had a profound influence on the negotiators of the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, UNFCCC, and its Kyoto Protocol. The meetings in The Hague in November 2000 and in Bonn in July 2001 were the second and third attempts to ratify, that is, to make legal, the protocols laid out in Kyoto in 1998. Unfortunately, President Bush pulled the USA out of the negotiations in March 2001. However, 191 other countries recognized by the UN made history in July 2001 by agreeing to the most far-reaching and comprehensive environmental treaty the world has ever seen. The Kyoto Protocol entered into force finally on 16 February 2005. It could only come into effect when Russia ratified the treaty, thereby meeting the requirement that at least 55 countries, representing 55% of the global emissions, signed up to it. In December 2007, the newly elected Labour Prime Minister Kevin Rudd of Australia signed the Kyoto Protocol, an act which was met with a standing ovation at the Bali meeting. As of April 2008, 178 countries out of a total of 192 recognized by the UN have ratified the treaty, leaving the USA as the only major country not to have signed up to Kyoto. The IPCC is organized into 3 working groups plus a task force to calculate the amount of greenhouse gases produced by each country. Each of these 4 bodies has 2 co-chairmen, one from a developed and one from a developing country, and a technical support unit. Working Group 1 assesses the scientific aspects of the climate system and climate change. Working Group 2 addresses the vulnerability of human and natural systems to climate change, the negative and positive consequences of climate change, and options for adapting to them. And Working Group 3 assesses options for limiting greenhouse gas emissions and otherwise mitigating climate change, as well as economic issues. Hence, the IPCC also provides governments with scientific, technical, and socioeconomic information relevant to evaluating the risks and to developing a response to global climate change. The latest reports from these three working groups were published in 2007, and approximately 400 experts from some 120 countries were directly involved in drafting, revising, and finalizing the IPCC reports, while another 2,500 experts participated in the review process. The IPCC authors are always nominated by governments and by international organizations, including non-governmental organizations. These reports are essential reading for anyone interested in global warming. In 2008, the IPCC was jointly awarded with Al Gore the Nobel Peace Prize to acknowledge all the work the IPCC has done over the past 20 years. The IPCC also compiles research on the main greenhouse gases, where they come from, and the current consensus concerning their warming potential. The warming potential is calculated in comparison with carbon dioxide, which is allocated a warming potential of 1. This way, the different greenhouse gases can be compared with each other relatively instead of in absolute terms. The global warming potential is calculated over both a 20 and 100-year period. This is because different greenhouse gases have different residence times in the atmosphere because of how long they take to break down or to be absorbed in the ocean or terrestrial biosphere. There are other greenhouse gases that are much more dangerous mass for mass than carbon dioxide and are much more effective at warming the atmosphere. But these exist in very low concentrations in the atmosphere, and therefore most of the debate concerning global warming still centers on the role and control of atmospheric carbon dioxide. What is climate change? Many scientists believe that the human-induced or anthropogenic-enhanced greenhouse effect will cause climate change in the near future. Even some of the global warming skeptics argue that though global warming may be a minor influence, natural climate change does occur on human timescales, and we should be prepared to adapt to it. But what is climate change, and how does it occur? Climate change can manifest itself in a number of ways. For example, changes in regional and global temperatures, changing rainfall patterns, expansion and contraction of ice sheets, and sea level variations. These regional and global climate changes are responses to external and/or internal forcing mechanisms. An example of an internal forcing mechanism is the variations in the carbon dioxide content of the atmosphere modulating the greenhouse effect, while a good example of an external forcing mechanism is the long-term variations in the Earth's orbits around the Sun, which alter the regional distribution of solar radiation to the Earth. This is thought to cause the waxing and waning of the ice ages. So in terms of looking for the evidence for global warming and predicting the future, we need to take account of all the natural, external, and internal forcing mechanisms. We can also try to abstract the way the global climate system responds to an internal or external forcing agent by examining different scenarios. In these scenarios, I am assuming that there is only one forcing mechanism which is trying to change the global climate. What is important is how the global climate system will react to the mechanism. For example, is the relationship like a person trying to push a car up a hill, which, strangely enough, produces very little response? Or is it more like a person pushing a car downhill, which, once the car starts to move, is very difficult to stop? There are four possible relationships, and this is the central question in the global warming debate. Which is most applicable to the future? A. Linear and synchronous response. In this case, the forcing produces a direct response in the climate system whose magnitude is in proportion to the forcing. In terms of global warming, an extra million tons of carbon dioxide would cause a certain predictable temperature increase. This can be equated to pushing a car along a flat road, most of the energy put into pushing is used to move the car forward. B. Muted or limited response. In this case, the forcing may be strong, but the climate system is in some way buffered and therefore gives very little response. Many global warming skeptics and politicians argue that the climate system is insensitive to changes in atmospheric carbon dioxide, so very little will happen in the future. This is the pushing the car up the hill analogy. You can spend as much energy as you like trying to push the car, but it will not move very far. C. Delayed or nonlinear response. In this case, the climate system may have a slow response to the forcing thanks to being buffered in some way. After an initial period, the climate system responds to the forcing, but in a nonlinear way. This is a real possibility when it comes to global warming, and why it is argued that only a small amount of warming has been observed over the last 100 years. This scenario can be equated to the car on the top of a hill. It takes some effort, and thus time, to push the car to the edge of the hill. This is the buffering effect. Once the car has reached the edge, it takes very little to push the car over, and then it accelerates down the hill with or without help. Once it reaches the bottom, the car then continues for some time, which is the overshoot, and then slows down of its own accord and settles into a new state. D. Threshold response. In this case, initially, there is no or very little response in the climate system to the forcing. However, all the response takes place in a very short period of time, in one large step or threshold. In many cases, the response may be much larger than one would expect from the size of the forcing, and this can be referred to as a response overshoot. This is the scenario that most worries scientists, as thresholds are very difficult to model and thus predict. However, thresholds have been found to be very common in the study of past climates, with rapid regional climate changes of over 5 degrees Celsius occurring within a few decades. This scenario equates to the bus hanging off the cliff at the end of the film The Italian Job. As long as there are only very small changes, nothing happens at all. However, a critical point, in this case weight, is reached, and the bus and the gold plunge off the cliff into the ravine below. Though these are purely theoretical models of how the global climate system can respond, they are important to keep in mind when reviewing the possible scenarios for future climate change. An added complication when assessing climate change is the possibility that climate thresholds contain bifurcations. This means the forcing required to go one way through the threshold is different from the reverse. This implies that once a climate threshold has occurred, it is a lot more difficult to reverse it. The bifurcation of the climate system has been inferred from ocean models, which mimic the impact of fresh water in the North Atlantic Ocean on the global deep water circulation. And we will discuss this can of worms in great detail in Chapter 6. Linking global warming with climate change. We have seen that there is clear evidence that greenhouse gas concentrations in the atmosphere have been rising since the Industrial Revolution in the 18th century. The current scientific consensus is that changes in greenhouse gas concentrations in the atmosphere do cause global temperature change. However, the biggest problem with the global warming hypothesis is understanding how sensitive the global climate is to increased levels of atmospheric carbon dioxide. Even if we establish this, predicting climate change is complex because it encompasses many different aspects which respond differently when the atmosphere warms up, including regional temperature changes, melting glaciers and ice sheets, relative sea level change, precipitation changes, storm intensity and tracks, El Niño, and even ocean circulation. This linkage between global warming and climate change is further complicated by the fact that each part of the global climate system has different response times. For example, the atmosphere can respond to external or internal changes within a day, but the deep ocean may take decades to respond. While vegetation can alter its structure within a few weeks, for example, change the amount of leaves, its composition, for example, evolving plant types, can take up to a century to change. Then, add to this the possibility of natural forcing, which may be cyclic. For example, there is good evidence that variations in solar output can affect climate over both a decadal and a century timescale. There is also evidence that since the beginning of our present interglacial period, the last 10,000 years, there have been climatic coolings every 1,500 plus or minus 500 years, of which the Little Ice Age was the last. The Little Ice Age began in the 17th and ended in the 18th century, and was characterized by a fall of 0.5 to 1 degree Celsius in Greenland temperatures, significant shift in the currents around Iceland, and a sea surface temperature fall of 4 degrees Celsius off the coast of West Africa and 2 degrees Celsius off the Bermuda Rise, all of which were due to natural climate change. But interestingly enough, the Little Ice Age was a regional effect and does not show up on global records. So we need to disentangle natural climate variability from global warming. We need to understand how the different parts of the climate system interact, remembering that they all have different response times. We need to understand what sort of climatic change will be caused and whether it will be gradual or catastrophic. We also need to understand how different regions of the world will be affected. For example, it is suggested that additional greenhouse gases will warm up the poles more than the tropics. All these themes concerning an understanding of the climate system and the difficulty of future climate prediction are returned to in chapters 3 and 4. So, if you are reading this book for the first time and are primarily interested in the science of global warming, then I would suggest you read chapters 3 to 6. However, I would encourage you also to read chapters 2 and 7, which look at the social, historic, economic, and political aspects of global warming, since global warming, as far as I'm concerned, cannot be seen solely as a scientific problem. Rather, it is a problem for our global society. Then, Chapter 8 concentrates on possible solutions for global warming, and Chapter 9 is my vision of a zero-carbon world. Chapter 2, A Brief History of the Global Warming Debate. Historical background. Scientists are predicting that global warming could warm the planet by between 1.1 and 6.4 degrees Celsius in the next 100 years, which economists suggest could cost as much as 20% of world GDP to deal with. In the face of such a threat, it is essential to understand the history of the global warming theory and the evidence that supports it. I will show that the whole debate over global warming clearly demonstrates how science is deeply influenced by society and vice versa. What we discover is that the essential science of global warming was carried out 50 years ago under the perceived necessity of geosciences during the Cold War, but it was not taken seriously as a theory until the late 1980s. I hope to give you some insight into why there was such a significant delay and why global warming has now become one of the biggest political problems facing humanity. It is now over 100 years since global warming was officially discovered. The pioneering work in 1896 by the Swedish scientist Svante Arrhenius and the subsequent independent confirmation by Thomas Chamberlain calculated that human activity could substantially warm the Earth by adding carbon dioxide to the atmosphere. This conclusion was the byproduct of other research, its major aim being to offer a theory whereby decreased carbon dioxide would explain the causes of the great ice ages. A theory that still stands today, but which had to wait until 1987 for the Antarctic Vostok Ice Core results to confirm the pivotal role of atmospheric CO2 in controlling past global climate. However, no one else took up the research topic, so both Arrhenius and Chamberlain turned to other challenges. This was because scientists at that time felt there were so many other influences on global climate, from sunspots to ocean circulation, that minor human influences were thought insignificant in comparison to the mighty forces of astronomy and geology. This idea was reinforced by research during the 1940s, which developed the theory that changes in the orbit of the Earth around the Sun controlled the waxing and waning of the Great Ice Ages. A second line of argument was that because there is 50 times more carbon dioxide in the oceans than in the atmosphere, the sea acts as a vast equalizer. In other words, the ocean would mop up our pollution. This dismissive view took its first blow when, in the 1940s, there was a significant improvement in infrared spectroscopy, the technique used to measure long-wave radiation. Up until the 1940s, experiments had shown that carbon dioxide did block the transmission of infrared, long-wave radiation of the sort given off by the Earth. However, the experiments showed there was very little change in this interception if the amount of carbon dioxide was doubled or halved. This meant that even small amounts of carbon dioxide could block radiation so thoroughly that adding more gas made very little difference. Moreover, water vapor, which is much more abundant than carbon dioxide, was found to block radiation in the same way, and therefore was thought to be more important. The Second World War saw a massive improvement in technology, and the old measurements of carbon dioxide radiation interception were revisited. In the original experiments, sea level pressure was used, but it was found that at the rarefied upper atmosphere pressures, the general absorption did not occur, and therefore radiation was able to pass through the upper atmosphere and into space. This proved that increasing the amount of carbon dioxide did result in absorption of more radiation. Moreover, it was found that water vapor absorbed other types of radiation rather than carbon dioxide, and to compound it all, it was also discovered that the stratosphere, the upper atmosphere, was bone dry. This work was brought together in 1955 by the calculations of Gilbert Plass, who concluded that adding more carbon dioxide to the atmosphere would intercept more infrared radiation, preventing it being lost to space, and thus warming the planet. This still left the argument that the oceans would soak up the extra anthropogenically produced carbon dioxide. The first new evidence came in the 1950s and showed that the average lifetime of a carbon dioxide molecule in the atmosphere before it dissolved in the sea was about 10 years. As the ocean, overturning, takes several hundreds of years, it was assumed the extra carbon dioxide would be safely locked in the oceans. But Roger Revelle, director of Scripps Institute of Oceanography in California, realized that it was necessary not only to know that a carbon dioxide molecule was absorbed after 10 years, but to ask, what happened to it after that? Did it stay there? Or diffuse back into the atmosphere? How much extra CO2 could the oceans hold? Revelle's calculations showed that the complexities of surface ocean chemistry are such that it returns much of the carbon dioxide that it absorbs. This was a great revelation, and showed that because of the peculiarities of ocean chemistry, the oceans would not be the complete sink for anthropogenic carbon dioxide that was first thought. This principle still holds true, although the exact amount of anthropogenic carbon dioxide taken up per year by the oceans is still in debate. It is thought to be about 2 gigatons, nearly one-third of the annual total anthropogenic production. Charles Keeling, who was hired by Roger Revelle, produced the next important step forward in the global warming debate. In the late 1950s and early 1960s, Keeling used the most modern technology available to measure the concentration of atmospheric CO2 in Antarctica and Mauna Loa. The resulting Keeling CO2 curves have continued to climb ominously each year since the first measurement in 1958 and have become one of the major icons of global warming. Cold War Science. Spencer Wiert, the director of the Center of History of Physics at the American Institute of Physics, contends that all the scientific facts about enhanced atmospheric CO2 and potential global warming were assembled by the late 1950s to early 1960s. He argues that it was only due to the physical geosciences being favored financially in the Cold War environment that so much of the fundamental work on global warming was completed. Gilbert Plass published an article in 1959 in Scientific American declaring that the world's temperature would rise by 3 degrees Celsius by the end of the century. The magazine editors published an accompanying photograph of coal smoke belching from factories, and the caption read, "Man upsets the balance of natural processes by adding billions of tons of carbon dioxide to the atmosphere each year." This resembles thousands of magazine articles, television news items, and documentaries that we have all seen since the late 1980s. So why was there a delay between the science of global warming being accepted and in place in the late 1950s and early 1960s, and the sudden realization of the true threat of global warming during the late 1980s? Why the delay in recognizing global warming? The key reasons for the delay in recognizing the global warming threat were, first, the power of the global mean temperature data set, and second, the need for the emergence of global environmental awareness. The global mean temperature data set is calculated using the land, air, and sea surface temperatures. From 1940 until the mid-1970s, the global temperature curve seems to have had a general downward trend. This provoked many scientists to discuss whether the Earth was entering the next great ice age. This fear developed in part because of increased awareness in the 1970s of how variable global climate had been in the past. The emerging subject of paleoceanography, study of past oceans, demonstrated from deep-sea sediments that there were at least 32 glacial-interglacial cold-warm cycles in the last 2.5 million years, not 4, as had been previously assumed. The time resolution of these studies was low, so that there was no possibility of estimating how quickly the ice ages came and went, only how regularly. It led many scientists and the media to ignore the scientific revelations of the 1950s and 1960s in favor of global cooling. As Pont, 1976, summarized, "Since the 1940s, the northern half of our planet has been cooling rapidly. Already the effect in the United States is the same as if every city had been picked up by giant hands and set down more than 100 miles closer to the North Pole. If the cooling continues," warned the National Academy of Sciences in 1975, "we could possibly witness the beginning of the next great ice age. Conceivably, some of us might live to see huge snowfields remaining year-round in northern regions of the United States and Europe. Probably we would see mass global famine in our lifetimes, perhaps even within a decade. Since 1970, 500,000 human beings in northern Africa and Asia have starved because of floods and droughts caused by the cooling climate." It was not until the early 1980s, when the global annual mean temperature curve started to increase, that the global cooling scenario was questioned. By the late 1980s, the global annual mean temperature curve rose so steeply that all the dormant evidence from the late 1950s and 1960s was given prominence and the global warming theory was in full swing. What is intriguing is that some of the most vocal advocates for the global warming theory were also the ones responsible for creating concern over the impending ice age. In the Genesis Strategy in 1976, Stephen Schneider stressed that the global cooling trend had set in. He is now one of the leading proponents of global warming. In 1990, he stated that the rate of change, warming, is so fast that I don't hesitate to call that kind of change potentially catastrophic for ecosystems. Why the hysteria? John Gribben, 1989, describes the transition very neatly in his book In Hothouse Earth, The Greenhouse Effect and Gaia. In 1981, it was possible to stand back and take a leisurely look at the record from 1880 to 1980. In 1987, the figures were updated to 1985, chiefly for neatness of adding another half a decade to the records. But by early 1988, even one more year's worth of data justified another publication in April, just 4 months after the last 1987 measurements were made, pointing out the record-breaking warmth now being reached. Even there, Hansen, James Hansen, head of the NASA team studying global temperature trends, and Lebedev were cautious about making the connection with the greenhouse effect, merely saying that this was a subject beyond the scope of this paper. But in the 4 months it had taken to get the 1987 data in print, the world had changed again. Just a few weeks later, Hansen was telling the U.S. Senate that the first 5 months of 1988 had been warmer than any comparable period since 1880, and the greenhouse effect was upon us. James Hansen's case had been made stronger by the fact that in 1986, British scientists Wigley and Jones also succeeded in compiling 134 years of global mean temperature data to show an unprecedented global warming trend starting in 1980, with the first 3 years being the warmest on the record. They had used different data and methods from other groups and thus served to increase confidence within the scientific community that global warming was underway. It seems, therefore, that the whole global warming issue was driven by the upturn in the global annual mean temperature data set, the so-called hockey stick. This in itself is interesting because some scientists in the early 1990s still believed that this was a flawed data set because, 1. Many of the land monitoring stations have subsequently been surrounded by urban areas, thus increasing the temperature records because of the urban heat island effect. 2. There have been changes in the ways ships measure the seawater temperature. 3. There was not an adequate explanation for the cooling trend in the 1970s. 4. Satellite data did not show a warming trend from the 1970s to the 1990s. And 5. The global warming models have overestimated the warming that should have occurred in the Northern Hemisphere over the last 100 years. Since the early 1990s, the urban heat island and variations in sea temperature measurements have been taken into account. We now know that the cooling trend of the 1960s and 1970s is due to the decadal influence of the sunspot cycle, and that pollutants, such as sulfur dioxide aerosols, cooled the industrial regions of the globe. In addition, the satellite results were spurious for a number of reasons, and a greater understanding of the system and recalibrated data show a significant warming trend. So the latest IPCC 2007 science report has reviewed and synthesized a wide range of data sets and shows that, essentially, the trend in the temperature data is correct, and that this warming trend has continued unstopped until the present day. In fact, we know that 1998 and 2005 were globally the warmest years on record. The temperatures for these 2 years are so close that scientists are divided on which is the warmest. However, 1998 was an El Niño year, which we know adds up to 1 degree Celsius on the average global temperatures. So we can say 2005 was the warmest normal year on record, with 2002, 2003, and 2004, respectively, 3rd, 4th, and 5th warmest. Indeed, the 12 warmest years on record have all occurred in the last 13 years, while a mild El Niño ensured that 2007 was the 8th warmest year on record. The upturn in the global annual mean temperature data was not the sole reason for the appearance of the global warming issue. In the late 1970s and 1980s, there were significant advances in global climate modeling and a marked improvement in our understanding of past climates. Developments in general circulation models, GCMs, during this period included taking into account the role of particles and clouds in affecting the global climate. Despite the cooling effect thought to be associated with particle pollution, the new ocean-atmosphere-coupled GCM tools emerged with revised and higher estimates of the warming that would be associated with a doubling of CO2 in the atmosphere. By the 1980s, scientific concern had emerged about CH4 and other non-CO2 greenhouse gases, as well as the role of the oceans as a carrier of heat. GCMs continued to improve, and the numbers of scientific teams working on such models increased over the 1980s and the 1990s. In 1992, a first overall comparison of results from 14 GCMs was undertaken. The results were all in rough overall agreement, confirming the prediction of global warming. In terms of the study of paleoclimate during the 1980s, there was also an intense drive to understand how and why past climate changed. Major advances were made in obtaining high-resolution past climate records from deep-sea sediments and ice cores. It was, thus, realized that glacial periods, or ice ages, take tens of thousands of years to occur, primarily because ice sheets are very slow to build up and are naturally unstable. In contrast, the transition to a warmer period, or interglacial, such as the present, is geologically very quick, in the order of a couple of thousand years. This is because once the ice sheets start to melt, there are a number of positive feedbacks that accelerate the process, such as sea level rise, which can undercut and destroy large ice sheets. The realization occurred in the paleoclimate community that global warming is much easier and more rapid than cooling. It also put to rest the myth of the next impending ice age. As the glacial-interglacial periods of the last 2.5